Hi, and welcome to another episode of Prime Cuts. This is your host, Chef Mark Gottlieb, and this week we'll be talking about chopped meat. That's right, I'm from New York and I call it chopped meat. The rest of you might call it ground beef, but by however it's known, it is simply beef that has been ground or chopped into small pieces. This goes back to the discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago about tenderizing meat. This is the mechanical method of tenderizing meat, where you grind it up so that the fibers of the meat are short enough to make them chewable, otherwise they would be tough and difficult to eat. Okay, so why did I pick this topic if I just kind of almost spoke about it a few weeks ago? Well, the reason is that I was drawn into an online discussion on Facebook about a week ago. There was quite a lengthy discussion, actually. It's one of those where, you thought it'd start off small, and then all of a sudden there are 100 and something comments on it, and everybody's got their opinion. Well, that's, everybody's certainly entitled to it, but I thought that some of the points that I made in the discussion were important enough that I wanted to discuss them further and give you my take on what chopped meat should be without the distractions of various opinions. Okay, so like I said, chopped meat is the mechanical shortening of the muscle fibers in a piece of meat to enhance its quality of eating. As such, chopped meat typically comes from the cuts of beef that are tougher, lesser quality, and on a beef that includes the number 2, which is the chuck roll, the number 8, the number 10, which is the neck meat. So these cuts have been responsible for holding the cow up and holding up its head for most of its life, and they are tougher cuts of meat than the tenderloin and the ribeye. And so cooking them in a way that would keep them pink would necessarily make them really too tough to chew. So that's why we grind them up so that we can enjoy these cuts of meat, the flavor. I mean, there is a lot of flavor in this meat, so we grind it up so we can enjoy it. Okay. So how much fat should be in your ground beef? Well, that depends. Now, I know health conscious people are going to say, well, fat, you can't have fat, but you have to have fat because these muscles, because they've been worked, are not lazy. They are not typically associated with amounts of fat. So you have to add it in order to keep the meat moist when you're cooking it. It's an important element of it. You can't have a hamburger that tastes good without fat. I have a friend, his name is Fred, and he quipped a very long time ago that calories are a unit of measure of flavor. And he is still right. Anyway, so when you have chopped meat, when you get plain chopped meat from the butcher's counter, it's not going to have fat in it. They don't want to grind up fat for you because they think that it's less appealing and whatnot. So that's good and bad. The good news is that, you're getting only you're paying whatever you're paying only for meat versus paying meat prices for what is essentially thrown away, the fat scraps. If you have a good butcher, and if you don't, I advise you to find one. You should make it your business to, when you're buying chopped meat, to also ask him to grind up fat. And you can ask him to do it separately, and you really should not be paying, the 30 to 40 shekel per kilo that you're paying for it. I've paid in the shuk on a bad day 15 shekel for a kilo of fat. All right, I mean, really, they should be giving it to you for free, but I'm not gonna quibble over 15 shekel, not when a kilo of it is going to last me for months. The proportion that I like to reach for fat to from meat to fat, I like 70 to 30. It's on the high side, but chopped meat isn't something that I consume on a regular basis, so I don't feel that I'm consuming, I don't feel it's too much for me. You can go to 80-20. Anywhere in that range is really fine. How do you get to that? Well, the simplest of math. If you're looking for a 70 to 30 ratio for every kilo of meat that you want, you measure out 700 grams of meat and 300 grams of fat, and then you mix them together. That's another reason you would want to get the fat ground separately from the meat, is that you can play with the percentage ratio until you have a comfortable mix. So when you're making chopped meat, let's assume hamburgers, since that was the nature of the original online discussion. So the question is, well, what do you put into a hamburger? Well, a lot of things are put into hamburgers all over the world, well, all over the United States. A lot of people are thinking that, well, you put in breadcrumbs and you put in eggs and you put in, you should stop right there. So you shouldn't put in eggs or breadcrumbs for two very good reasons. One, breadcrumbs don't belong in hamburgers, and two, eggs don't belong in hamburgers. Now, breadcrumbs in chopped meat act as an absorbent. It's a filler that absorbs extra liquid. Why you would want this in your hamburger defies rationale. You don't want anything drawing moisture out of the meat. On the opposite, you want to keep the moisture in the meat, and adding breadcrumbs is really kind of like the dumbest thing you can do for a hamburger. Now, it has its place in other recipe and chopped meat preparations, and I'll discuss those later on. But if you're making a hamburger, leave out the breadcrumbs. Likewise, if you're making a hamburger, leave out the eggs. Egg is an unnecessary binder. You want to keep your meat together. You don't want it to fall apart in your hamburger, and that's understandable, but there's no reason to introduce an egg into the mix. That got lost in translation somewhere along the line. What do I mean by that? Well, one of the lesser well-known chopped meat preparations that is steak tartare, which everybody knows is raw meat. Yes, it's raw meat, but you're not eating it like some half-starved animal. Steak tartare is a preparation of very high-quality beef, raw, very fresh. It has some flavors that are chopped up into it. Let me look it up. So steak tartare has capers and onions, and it has an egg yolk. Okay, so all the health conscious people are gonna go nuts. It's raw beef, it's raw egg, it's salmonella, it's all sorts of things. And yes, it's a dish that requires a little bit of courage to taste for the first time. I've had it. It's not my thing, but it wasn't horrific. Steak tartare, interestingly enough, the origins of it aren't very well known, but the Tartars were horsemen. And think of the Riders of Rohan if you're into Lord of the Rings. And the Tartars were thought to have given the name to the dish steak tartare, that it was originally made from horse meat. We wandered well off the path of where I want to be. But steak, so that's my opinion, is that people have added eggs to hamburgers sort of as a mix-up of the steak tartare recipe and when you're using enough fat and you're using salt, which you should be using in your chopped meat preparation, that is enough to bind the meat proteins to one another and keep them from falling apart in the pan. If you don't want to use salt, you're not going to have a cohesive hamburger. If you're not going to use fat, you're not going to have a cohesive hamburger. This is simple kitchen science. Okay. So what's another recipe that uses chopped meat? Well, meatballs is the second most popular, I suppose. And in my class for the cooking class for the kids, I teach them how to make meatballs and spaghetti. In that recipe, I do use eggs and breadcrumbs for a couple of reasons. One, the breadcrumbs as a filler, it makes more of it, and also teaching them after we roast them. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. I make meatballs. I prepare the mix of meat and onions and egg and breadcrumbs and seasonings, and then I roll them into uniform meatballs. Then I roast them in the oven, and after I roast them in the oven, then I put them in a pot of sauce and let them absorb flavor from that, and then the meatballs and spaghetti get served. So instead of applying direct heat from a pan to a patty of meat, I am roasting in the oven. So I don't have that searing effect and the Mylar process that help to keep the hamburger, to help to hold the hamburger together. I roast in the oven, it's indirect heat, and that draws out moisture rather than sealing it in, as it were. It's a bit of a misnomer, but that's another discussion. Afterwards, I put them in a pot, so I really want to make sure that the meatballs stay together, so I add these additional ingredients that keep the moisture in rather than letting it leach out in the oven. And as I'm boiling these things, I don't want the bindings of, I can't rely on the binding of just the meat itself to keep the meatballs together, so I fortify it with egg protein. So it does not belong in hamburger. Meatballs, it absolutely does belong in. Okay. Stuffed cabbage. Well, stuffed cabbage is like a big meatball wrapped up in a cabbage leaf. Except that I don't have to worry about it coming apart because I'm using the leaf itself to keep the stuffed cabbage together. So what I do instead is I take raw rice and I put it in with the chopped meat stuffing. And when the rice absorbs the liquid from the sauce that it's sitting in as it's cooking, the rice expands and it tightens up the stuffed cabbage. It gives you a nice solid stuffed cabbage. All right, so that's that, that's that. Okay. Meatloaf. I have very mixed opinions about meatloaf, if you ask my wife. I deplore it in one respect, and I don't mind making it myself. Okay, so I don't like eating meatloaf. I mean, obviously, if I'm being served meatloaf at a dinner or lunch, I'm certainly not going to disparage it. I'm going to eat it and smile. I don't like meatloaf because I think meatloaf shows a tremendous lack of originality in most parts, because what people do is they take chopped meat, they dump it in a bowl, maybe they, or a loaf pan, maybe they shape it, they will almost invariably take ketchup and pour it over the meatloaf, and then they will bake it until it is shot to hell, and this somehow is supposed to represent dinner. I think it's disrespectful to the animal who gave its life for us to consume the meat that is provided by being almost completely disingenuous about how we prepare it. And I have a problem with that. A meatloaf can be so many wonderful things. I have stuffed it with spinach, I've stuffed it with mushrooms and onions, I've mixed turkey and beef and rolled it in a pinwheel. I try to do things that make, when I'm given the opportunity to make meatloaf, I try to do things that are a little bit more inspired. I actually find cooking one of the magazines that I subscribe to, thanks to my mother-in-law, it's my annual birthday present. Had a mix and match article a while back about how to spruce up your meatloaf. There are measurable ways that you can take a kilo of chopped meat and make it into something interesting. Dumping it into a pan with ketchup on it is none of them. And the next dish to talk about, well, I can talk about anything, but okay, so Salisbury steak is a lot fancier sounding than it is. Basically, it's a hamburger served without a bun on a plate. So in the restaurant that we serve Salisbury steak, it was basically two hamburgers that were reformed into one oblong. It was called a mini meatloaf, just, and then it was grilled, roasted, and it was served with a meat sauce, and that's Salisbury steak, the long and the short of it. So if you want to be a little bit fancy, instead of making two hamburgers per person, make one oval-shaped loaf of meat per person and prepare a simple brown sauce and serve it with. And of course, if you have French fries, you can't go wrong. In Israel, if you go to a shepudia, a skewer restaurant, one of the offerings is the house, what I would call shishlik, which is basically hamburger on a stick. And although I'm not often tempted to try the house shishlik, I really should, because it's the one thing that they get to season, little chunks of steak and chicken wings and sweetbreads and stuff like that are all nice and fun, but really I should try the shishlik if I'm going to judge a restaurant by its ability to actually prepare something and not just shove it on a stick and burn it. So yeah, shishlik is kind of like, it's more than a hamburger on a stick, it's more like sausage on a stick, and that brings me to next application of chopped meat, which is sausages. So, if you're making your own sausages or contemplating making your own sausages, I don't start with meat that's already been chopped. I start with whole meat and I grind it myself. But sausages are, at their very core is highly seasoned chopped meat. What you put into it, it gives it the nature of its flavor and whatnot, but sausages are, are chopped meat. You can't shove it into a casing if it's not all ground up. A more refined version of sausages would call force meat, where pâtés and terrines and other charcuterie preparations are made by the grinding and or emulsification of meat, and applications are too many to go into in discussion of this nature, but so the next dish I want to talk about that uses chopped meat originated in Iowa in the 30s. It comes in America's Depression era, and that's Sloppy Joe's, which is the opposite of everything we've been talking about, which is how to get chopped meat to stick together. Sloppy Joe is chopped meat that's been browned and sauced and served on a bun, and it's a hamburger that didn't come together. It was probably one of these things that were, it's probably one of these things that were invented by accident, where, you know, a hamburger went wrong, so we just put it on a bun and threw some sauce on it, and all of a sudden truck drivers from all over are eating this magnificent mess on a plate. Related to the Sloppy Joe, it's a much older sauce, it's a much older sauce called Bolognese, and it comes from Bologna, Italy, and interestingly enough, Bolognese sauce is the only sauce in the Italian cooking lexicon that has a legal definition. There is a legal and proper way to make Bolognese sauce as defined by the city of Bologna, which I always find to be hysterical. I don't know why, it just cracks me up that there's a legal way to make sauce Bolognese, which implies that there is an illegal way to make sauce Bolognese as well. Okay, so that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and I encourage you to write in any questions that you have, because we're about 1 week into the contest, and by the end of February, I'll be taking your best question and answering it on Prime Cuts, and that question, and the person who asks that question will be receiving a prize of their very own meat thermometer. I know it sounds a lot more exciting than it is, but truth is, you haven't lived until you had a meat thermometer. All right, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. See you next week.